You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Children eat worms and bugs and all sorts of things when they crawl in around.
The Wire.
They may be known as green homes, but there's plenty of grey areas. Academics such as the University of Auckland's Dr. Michael Rim believe that the humidity standards on these eco-friendly builds need to be reassessed. I spoke to Michael about these standards and whether they are effective. How do factors such as dryness or dampness get misinterpreted in green home ratings?
Well, the dryness side of things, generally the preferred metric is relative humidity. And the study that we did on a green home, a multi-unit green home, it was for pensioners, subsidized rental. Found that if you take that metric, and generally the rule of thumb is to stay between 40% and 60% relative humidity, that's kind of the target. That particular building, even though the occupants absolutely loved it and they were incredibly happy and comfortable through the winters, through the summers, we interviewed them in both periods, it almost never stayed under 60% relative humidity in the wintertime. So on face value, since we are so focused on relative humidity, that building sort of fails in a sense. But one point we made in the paper is that's not really fair, particularly in our climate in the wintertime where it's quite wet conditions and a bit cool. Relative humidity ends up being very, very high. And it's unrealistic for us to expect that our interiors in the wintertime in this country can kind of get down to the 50% sweet spot in terms of relative humidity. But there are other measures. And so we looked at absolute humidity. So relative humidity is the amount of moisture in the air based on the capacity of the air to hold moisture at a certain temperature. So the warmer air is, the more capacity it has to hold moisture. The cooler the air is, the less capacity it has. That's why you have things like condensation on windows in the morning. The air must release excess water vapor, and it condenses onto surfaces like walls or on windows and things like that. Whereas absolute humidity measures the actual content of water vapor in the air. And one thing that we made a point in the paper is that if you focus solely on relative humidity, there's a couple ways you could kind of get relative humidity in our environment, in our winter environment, down to, say, 40 to 60%, which is the target generally. One is to heat up the air, which takes energy. And for some people, that's maybe not what they want. They don't want high temperatures inside. Again, the property that we studied were pensioners on subsidized rental. That comes at a cost, heating up the interior. So they might just throw on a jumper or something like that and be quite fine. The other way you could do it is through dehumidifying. And again, that's throwing energy at the issue and trying to dry out the air. One thing that we point out in the paper is in the 70s, after the oil crises, the target of relative humidity was amped up all the way up to 90%. And that was simply a function of how much energy it takes to try to reduce relative humidity in office spaces and other kind of public buildings. So a point that we make in the paper is if we throw energy at the problem, while we expend the energy, energy comes at a cost. And at the end of the day, we might not actually be achieving a healthier indoor environment. Another kind of point to make is that indoors that are too dry tend to enable the transmission of viruses. You get sick. Think of a long-haul flight, very dry air inside the cabins. It's one reason why we get sick on planes, because we're more susceptible to catching viruses in very dry environments. So if we blindly follow the relative humidity guidelines in a climate like ours in the wintertime, we could very well expend more energy than we need, and we could end up in a situation where we actually have less healthy indoor environments. So the takeaway that we came is consider both relative humidity, but also absolute humidity, and be kind of kinder to ourselves and realize that the climate that we're in will never hit that 40 to 60% in our buildings without expending massive volumes of energy to try to achieve that. And we don't end up with more comfortable, healthier environments by doing so.
And despite high relative humidity levels, most residents felt comfortable, right? So what does this suggest what does that suggest about current standards?
Well, if you get relative humidity is very useful because once you get up to 100%, that's when you have condensation. That's when you get mold. So you can't ignore it entirely. But if you're up in the 70%, for example, 75, 80%, when the oil crisis happened, they jacked it all the way up to 90%. Even at 90%, that's fine. You're not going to have condensation. So you could still have very comfortable, healthy indoor environments. So you do have to be cautious of that 100%. That's when you get the telltale signs of, you know, moisture condensing on corners of the room, and that's where mold will grow. That is a problem. But in the case of the building we looked at, it never got anywhere close to that. It was outside of the 40 to 60, but the residents were incredibly happy with their setup, and they were, you know, they were quite pleased.
How might your research influence how we design or assess healthy homes going forward?
Well, definitely, you know, this particular building is a Homestar 7 rated, and what I wouldn't want to have happen is somebody look at, say, data on relative humidity in the wintertime and think this is a failed building. That is not an accurate assessment. It's a very successful, healthy building. And therefore, I think in our environment, we need to look beyond just, say, relative humidity as a metric of the moisture in the air in our indoor environments. We should consider absolute humidity and look at both metrics, particularly in the wintertime here in New Zealand.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.